1920s. But before I begin, I want to thank Martin Prévost, a little bit of a French twist there, as well as the director Ricard Witzmann for actually inviting me to give you a more full-length talk around this topic of 1920s jazz in Istanbul. As he mentioned, I have given two previous talks in Istanbul, but only 15 or 20 minutes in length, and not near enough time to actually provide the sound as well as visual information that will hopefully, which is what I'm wanting all of you to take away from this talk, is for the most part, I want you to think and navigate through Beowulf differently. I want you to somehow hear the sounds differently that might have been played, actually, in the various jazz clubs throughout Beowulf. I also want you to think about the space of the district differently, hopefully. Something that sort of helps us to excavate this one particular period, which has actually very few traces. Not even Maxim's Gazinosu, which I think most of us are aware of on Citadel Village. That also, in terms of the space of jazz performance, no longer really exists. The Garden Bar, which now, if we all know, we know Tepi Basha, right? And so the little wonderful parataxi stand, which is very, very reliable, that was the site of the Garden Bar. Another really important site to this early jazz scene that I've been excavating. So we really have to look hard to sort of think about how we start to hear, listen, and visualize the city differently. And so what I'm doing is I'm trying to offer you this through jazz. Now, early jazz, just to provide a little bit of historical context, we need to think about this tumultuous period. So roughly World War I, 1914, 1918, then we move into the occupation period, 1918 to roughly 1923. Then we have the establishment of the Republic in 1923. So in terms of what I'm looking at and how I understand jazz culture specifically for the early Republican period, it's roughly situated between 1918 all the way up to roughly 1932. 1932 is when you have the law, 2007, which was actually passed in terms of it being instituted. That's a different kind of an issue that I won't be able to take up tonight. But that law basically states that particular service professions are no longer available for non-Muslims as well as for foreigners. That, in particular, purportedly does end up stymieing off and halting a particular kind of flow of Black American jazzers that I've been able to recuperate from the African American press to Istanbul. So that's my cutoff point. So that's how I sort of understand jazz culture in terms of the time frame. So it's a tumultuous period. We have a lot of individuals, refugees moving into the city, including Russian refugees. 1917, the Russian Revolution, is a really important date that factors into the overall changing leisure landscape of the district as well as the city at large. So, what I want to start off with is a story to help recreate this scene. And the story really focuses around the title, Constantown. That's a particular narrative device. So be patient as I read through just a setting of early jazz that coincides with the İşgal Zamanında, the occupation period. Okay? The Toronto Star's October 28, 1922 article, Old Constantown, penned by the late Ernest Hemingway, acquainted his readers with the sights, smells, tastes, and sounds of the post-World War I city of Constantinople. During the post-armistice period, Constantinople had continued to be a terminus or way station for a congestion of refugees. Soaring bread prices and housing costs complicated everyday life at a time when the city was swollen to its seams and continuing to swell with 1 million plus inhabitants and an upwards of 100,000 refugees. U.S. journalist Solita Solano described the streets of Pera as, quote, alive with Allied soldiers, refugees, relief workers, adventurers, peddlers, beggars, and a few tourists. By the time Hemingway arrived, the city had become a makeshift residence for a fleet of U.S. sailors who had begun to arrive in 1919. In that year, the detachment included 2 subchasers, 9 destroyers, and light cruisers, and they were buoyed right in front of Dolmabahce Sarai. The fleet was part of U.S. President Woodrow Wilson's intent of protecting U.S. political and civilian interests in the region, and the civilian colony at that time, as being reported in the press, was roughly, in the U.S. press, was roughly between 300 and 400. From 1919 until the fleet's effective departure on September 23, 1923, the U.S. sailors docked and set up shop. On days off, they rambled through the city, and in the night, there was a bit of carousing in the district's bars, which catered to a clientele that had a penchant for drink, as well as an ear for upbeat, syncopated, jazzy tunes. By December of that same year, a team of sailors began publishing an 8-to-10-page weekly printed by Zeliç and Sons, or Zeliç Frères. So for all of us now, since we're living in Istanbul, Zeliç Frères, the printing house of the Farsi's publication that I am drawing a lot upon, is right now Pantev Protasti across from Oda Kule. Okay? And that's just a stationery store. The actual printing area of Farsi's, that was taking place on Seydari Ekran Caddesi. Okay, just for us to sort of visualize it. The weekly offered news of the Navy in the region for a relatively broad readership, with subscribers spanning the region and reaching as far as, I have to say this, the U.S. state of Colorado, which is where I'm currently teaching, and I had to throw in that little bit of connection. I'm like, great, there is some kind of contact with Istanbul all the way there in the mountains. Okay. Of interest is that every subsequent issue provided a weekly schedule of upcoming balls, dances, and sponsored events in Constantinople. So by the early 1920s, early jazz was docking, and I like to use this idea of docking. Literally, it's sort of landing for very specific reasons, actually, in terms of tour of duty, as opposed to individuals who voluntarily happen to find themselves in Constantinople, which is a little bit different from our Black American jazzers who were going to be introduced a little bit later. They are actually looking for employment. The sailors happen to find themselves here because they happen to be U.S. Navy. So it's a completely different sort of context for them. In the Far Seas, a picture of the district of Paris amateur jazz culture emerges in very informal spaces that I will end up talking about in a bit. The station destroyers provided a jazz band staple for various events. There are calls for amateur banjo, saxophone, piano, drum, and cornet players, which are peppered throughout the weekly editions. There's also announcements of the St. Lou Jazz Band. The St. Lou Jazz Band, it's sort of referenced there. There's no actual picture of this group of amateur sailor musicians. However, all of the musicians were attached to the USS St. Louis, which was one of the 2 main destroyers who was actually docked outside of the Dolmabahce Palace. The other main destroyer that does reportedly have a jazz band attached to it is the USS Scorpion. One writer in the Far Seas described their performance style, i.e., the USS St. Louis jazz band's performance style, at, interesting enough, weekly Knights of Columbus dances as, quote, cutting loose with their throttle wide open and all cans lid off, adding, and believe me, they tore through a mean line of syncopation. Of note in this particular description is that local musicians were also part of the scene and commended for their skills without too much more information. Okay, so a little aside. In terms of the research that I've been doing for the 1920s, there's actually very little reference that I've come across as it pertains to local jazz musicians or local musicians of any sort, if they're coming from the conservatory. I absolutely have no idea because that kind of information isn't provided. However, we do have sort of an inkling that, you know, local musicians, be they Muslim or non-Muslim, that's also not really specific. They're somehow part of this really informal, and I want to say informal jazz scene, especially as it's attached to the U.S. sailors who are coming into the city. Okay, so now I want to move into the next section of the talk. Oh, I guess maybe I should mention sort of something about the images. Sort of forgot about that. Okay, I think this is an interesting sort of satire of the kind of frolicking that was attached to these kinds of sailor performances, as best that I've been able to capture from the far seas. But we do have a few photographs that are coming out of this one publication. And this one, actually, the Sultan of Samsun, there's really very little information about it. However, it is falling along the lines of a vaudeville-esque variety style show. There are references in the far seas to blackface, to cross-gender dressing, but that's part of these skits that are part of this vaudeville repertoire. Okay, and then obviously it's taking place at the Petit Champ Theater. So, for all of us who love Istanbul in this district, where the Parapalace, the Garden Bar, is now the Parataxi Stand, and the Petit Champ Theater would be, what, the Belvedere, the parking structure. Yeah, well, not entirely there. A little, it's right, you know where the Chai Bachesi is? Okay, in that area. That's where the theater would have been. Okay. So the reason why I'm using Constantown as a device is I think it's useful in terms of zooming in on the actors who are attached to the specific 1920s jazz scene. Again, primarily U.S. sailor musicians. I'm not speaking in terms of European jazzers. That I have not been able to trace. That's sort of one portion of the pie that maybe somebody else can start investigating. Yay. Okay, as well as the Black Americans. So I think Constantown provides a very interesting narrative device to hone in specifically on the groups that I'm looking at. Constantown also provides a way to sort of think specifically about these post-war dynamics, these changing demographics, as well as a leisure landscape that you as amateur sailor musicians, as well as touring Black American performers, and by that I mean choreographers, musicians, dancers, and singers, participated in and contributed to this idea of Constantown, which the reference does pop up. And this is one reason why I ended up using this image from the far seas. So you have another way in which Constant is actually being used. I think the story of Constantown also suggests different ways to then think about the district's post-armistice history, which extends into the early years of the Republic that I briefly hinted at through the lens of jazz. So in my larger book project, Constantown is one particular item that is isolated out, as is the lens of jazz culture, not just a jazz scene, as well as jazz chronology. And I think both of these ideas allows us to think about four different things. One, how does jazz culture operate in 1920s Constantinople? What is the legacy of early jazz performance in the city, as well as in the district specifically? How does jazz culture and jazz chronology possibly disrupt the centrality of New Orleans without replacing it in this jazz narrative? And four, how do the historical dynamics influence the history of how early jazz actually emerges in the city? So keeping in mind, and this is also attached to jazz culture, that the popularity of social dancing, because when we think about the sounds, the syncopation of the music, that is also attached to a physical expression of the body, and a different way of dress, and a different way of movement, that in very much it starts to resonate in terms of the direction that the early republic is operating in. This idea of secularization. I hate to use this term, but for lack of a better word, let's say a kind of westernizing approach, but when we actually hone in specifically, it is around manners of behavior, manners of dress, that jazz percolates throughout. Also, we have at the same time, American movies are starting to pop up during this time period in these leisure spaces. Fashions as well as professional sports, like emphasis on football, emphasis on wrestling as well. Which also, I think, necessitates that people, there's a keeping up with the spirit of the time. It's not only in Constantinople that the interest towards American movies, this popularity of social dancing, is taking place. This moves into the idea of this transnational leisure landscape that we find here. Okay, a little bit more about jazz culture. Okay, the image that I have, granted it's from a later period, it's 1927. For those of you who can't read in the back, it's from the magazine Vieux Gazette. And you'll note, and we don't really have to read too much into it, but there's no specific details given about the black jazz drummer who's being represented in the image. It could be simply a pirated image, quite possibly. It does not necessarily mean that this image is reflective of this individual actually having played and performed in Constantinople, but we don't really know. Okay, so back to the idea of jazz culture. I use this term as a cue and a circuit to identify transnational intersections. Jazz culture, defined broadly as I have it up here, includes places where nightlife, music, dance performance, and illustrated print culture collide with newspaper reportage, scientific discourses on health and the body, and policing. So this is way more expansive, and this is sort of the intersectional idea of how the streets, even in terms of reading the press of the time, i.e. in the 1920s, we can start to isolate out the consumerism and the commercialism that's expansive, that's around people wearing the right dancing shoes. Women being able to go to a tassie and get a knee-length skirt in order to dance the Charleston. You cannot dance the Charleston if you happen to be wearing a long skirt, right? Even bobbing the hair, perfect example, as opposed to long hair. Just sort of that, you think about the expression of the body as it pertains to the Charleston as being reflective of this dance music. And we're having a completely different expression in the dance halls that are emerging. Not that there weren't dance halls, but we're starting to see this influence of social dancing as it pertains to early jazz. Jazz culture also connotes a new set of social mores, fashions, gender relations, and consumer practices that produce new understandings of social space and intimacy. So what this means for the time period is that jazz culture intersects with specific interwar transnational experiences. And here I want to draw upon, I'm not going to be making a lot of references to scholars, however, I do think that Daphne Brooks, who's located at Princeton, she's actually a scholar of African-American theater, and she suggests in her work, Bodies of Descent, that you can understand these transnational intersections as a transatlantic framing for reading the meanings and productions of bodies. And I think it's useful to think about this transatlantic framing that's actually pushing into the Eastern Mediterranean. So it's actually positioning Constantinople in terms of a much larger map of dialogue around these activities. Jazz culture also, and I've mentioned, it emerges at a very specific time that's also reflective of a tumultuous period, economically, politically, socially, culturally, in the city. Okay, this is always a question that comes up, the audience. Who the hell was listening to jazz? Who was going into the Garden Bar? Who was going into Maxime's? Who was going into the Petit Champ Theater? I have absolutely no idea. I am not going to be able to answer that question specifically. I don't know how many people were dancing the Charleston. I don't know how many Muslims or non-Muslims were actually. However, if we think expansively, drawing upon this print culture, drawing upon the description of these spaces, then I think we can have at least a suggestion that this is a mixed audience. Now, granted, during the occupation period, for specific sponsored balls, like at the Navy Club or at the Knights of Columbus or even at the U.S. Embassy, there is going to be a component of Americans who are going to be participating in these activities. But it's not exclusive as far as I can tell outside of the embassy. In terms of dances that are taking place at the Parapalis, you do not necessarily have to have an invitation. So it's going to be class-based as well. It's going to be mixed. Another thing in terms of the audience, we don't necessarily have to just assume that an audience connotes individuals who are actually in the space, who are actually listening, who are actually dancing, who might be attending these parties. In terms of one aspect of my research, which also looks into the ways in which post-Ottoman cultural critics using the space of the illustrated magazines are writing about these kinds of practices, then we can sort of make this audience a little bit more expansive. And part of that they're reporting on is that these spaces are mixed in terms of class, are still mixed in terms of ethnicity, which I'll talk about later because this becomes the basis for the contours of what we can start thinking of as early jazz Turkish criticism. I don't think I have all of my adjectives in the right order, but it works. Okay, another thing in terms of the audience. People who have access in terms of the readership of these magazines, i.e. of Büyük Gazete, of Resimli Gazete, of Asri Hafta, we can also think about this imaginary audience, individuals who might not necessarily be going into these spaces, but somehow are voyeuristically engaging in these spaces simply by reading the descriptions. So we can sort of think about this much broader idea of audience. Now we go on to the next idea. Here is an image of the Garden Bar from 1927. I do not know who the photographer is. And this is in the Illustrated Magazine, Racine Lee Jumas. So in the broader project, I think jazz chronology helps us to highlight a different time frame that navigates between this late Ottoman period into the early Turkish Republic. And part of navigating and providing a different kind of chronology is specifically to start pinpointing what kinds of cultural influences, as attached to jazz, starts to amplify the kinds of reforms after 1923 that we're all very familiar with, in terms of the hat reform of 1925, in terms of the Lange reform of 1928, in terms of these very top-down scripted reforms that change notions of clothing and dress and time. Jazz chronology also allows us to start thinking about the introduction of vaudeville-esque performances into the city. So this taps into another element, which is black performance. What is the history of black performance in Constantinople that predates even the arrival of the U.S. amateur sailor musicians? Vaudeville, the late 19th and early 20th century genre of performance or theatrical entertainment, which includes minstrelsy, blackface, and ragtime, that all feed into this rhythmic and syncopated vocabulary of what starts to be understood as early jazz. So it's very fluid. And it's also not entirely exclusive. We can also think of vaudeville as this umbrella term that's composed of different performance styles that in some ways, most definitively, enact the history of American slavery for viewing and listening audiences. The soundtrack. I'm going to be playing you some audio clips of the black American performers who are coming into the city. Haha, we have another problem because we actually don't have an oral and audio record of the jazz performances. We don't have a sense, we don't have any recordings in terms of what people were actually playing in these spaces. However, by documenting, and this is where for me jazz is also sort of an expression of this creative innovation. So by marrying the artists with recordings from the time period, i.e. the same years, that were being printed either in Berlin and Paris, I'm trying to also think about what does this actual oral soundscape sound like? This is going to be the last top-heavy PowerPoint until before we get into the music. Okay, so circulating narratives and frameworks. What I have here is only a section of Sam Wooding, who was an African-American early jazz band leader who actually ends up making his name outside of the U.S. So he's really attached to the European scene. And he actually ends up going back to the U.S. around the 40s and 50s, come back to perform in Istanbul at the Hilton Hotel in the 60s, actually. But this is actually coming from his promotional company, which is called Pan Jebel. And you'll note Istanbul and the Petitional Theater is listed right there. However, what I find interesting about this list of places where he performed at, as well as musicians that he's performing with, is you start to have a mapping of what this transnational jazz scene looks like outside of the U.S. Because that's what we're actually focusing on. We're focusing on these black performers who are coming to Constantinople, who for the most part completely fall out of the U.S.-based jazz traditional narrative. They end up making their lives, they end up making their performance styles in Europe, as well as in Southeast Asia, also as well as traveling to South America. Okay, so in terms of this idea of transnational jazz, now granted, this last question around, is this cosmopolitanism? I just want to throw it up there, but we're not really going to engage in this. Because I really am trying to divert away from the idea of this is just an expression of cosmopolitanism, because if we think about jazz, jazz is transnational. It's popping up everywhere at the same time. It is not locally bound. There's nothing that is intricate or specific in terms of jazz being an expression of any kind of indigenous cultural form. So I think this is where we can start thinking about what does transnationalism, in terms of an idea, allow us to isolate out. So to think about that, I'm going to read one section of a very well-cited article from 1922, written by Burnett Hershey, who was a writer for the New York Times. And what it's oft-cited because it helps to provide a particular kind of context for thinking about jazz popping up everywhere at the same time. So it's very jagged and it's very tectonic. Okay, so as he was touring the world in 1922, he writes in this article, Jazz Latitude, a new line of latitude one steps around the globe. Its location is reckoned by the degree of its jazz and composed and computed exactly by the number of minutes and seconds it is distant from its meridian, Tin Pan Alley. To trace it, you don't have to be a student of geography. Even the amateur globetrotter on an automatic tour won't need his Baedeker travel guide to find it. For every ship the traveler takes today throbs with a staccato cacophony of jazz, and every stop at a port is punctuated by the syncopation of jazz. Okay, Tin Pan Alley. This is the starting point. Tin Pan Alley would have been the publishing center in New York City. That's the reference point. Now, in his circumvention around the globe in 1922, what is interesting about his travel is that he completely uses a different line of navigation. He does not provide a line of navigation that goes from New Orleans to Kansas City to Chicago to New York to Paris and everywhere else. What he does instead is he provides this navigation around the globe, but he starts on the Pacific coast. So he leaves from San Francisco, and he hops on over to Japan, and then he hops down to Borneo, and then he goes around to Ceylon, and then he somehow makes his way to Cairo, and then he makes his way through European urban centers before he then finally descends upon New York. And that right there is an interesting intervention into this very unidirectional grand jazz narrative, which I've just briefly described for you. New Orleans, New York, Paris, everywhere else. Okay. This traditional jazz narrative and the role of 19th century black performance, I'm going to come to both of those as I introduce you to the black American musicians, okay? I'm going to take just a little. I wish I were a camel. Okay. We're going into the next little bit. Okay. So another major narrative in terms of jazz studies is, okay, how was jazz actually introduced to Europe? And the key figure he was pinpointed is James Rhys Europe and the 369th Infantry Regiment, or the Harlem Hellfighters, who make their way into Paris during World War I. They happen to be the conduit for then, now we have jazz in the European front, and they somehow figure very appropriately because they also are traveling with a really social dancing duo called Vernon and Irene Castle. I don't want to spend too much time with them, but at the same time that they're introducing early jazz, this kind of syncopation, to Parisian audiences, at the same time, social dancing of the one-step and the foxtrot are also being introduced to European audiences. So that's just sort of the little historical context. In terms of syncopation, okay, this would be, I'm going to give you, just so you can start thinking, for those of you who maybe are unfamiliar with this kind of music, I want you to be able to tune your ear to it. So, if we have a basic four-beat structure, this would be on the beat. One, two, three, four. Okay, four time. If we're looking at syncopated, this is the beat, right? Pretty basic rendering, right, Martin? Do you approve? Okay, so beat. So it's just on the offbeat. That provides you with a sense of syncopation, which is this new sort of rhythmic vocabulary that is indeed sort of impacting dancing. So let, without further ado, listen to this sound. Thank you. idea, because we have a lot more to listen to. Okay. So, now we're entering into how to sort of overturn and complicate this traditional jazz narrative that Constantinople is actually a part of. And this is when we're moving into documenting this history of black performers. Right now, I'm documenting primarily black American performers who are coming in. It does not mean that there are not black European performers that actually predate James Rhys Europe, actually going over to Paris. This is also, I want us to start keeping track, I'll come back to this, in terms of what are the different black performance typologies? What are the kinds of representations of black performance that people, a mixed audience, might be encountering in terms of live performance, as well as in the pages of the press, so captured in terms of photographs. So this is part of a much larger sort of thinking about black performance typologies. When we think about 19th century black performance, this gets into this history of vaudeville, to this enactment of this U.S. history of slavery. It is a part of it, because Bonnie and Freeman, as well as other black American artists that end up making their way to Istanbul, they end up leaving the U.S. in the late 19th century, some even earlier by 1868, specifically to leave the Jim Crow laws of segregation. So there's already a particular impetus in terms of, you know, what variety, how we would maybe start thinking about their actual caliber of performance. I think that's a moot point. But we do have this populated scene of musicians who are circulating. Going back to Daphne Brooks yet again, I think she also provides us with a sense of thinking about black performance as performed not by white U.S. sailor amateur musicians, but by these black performers themselves, who are very much aware of the stigmatization of blackface, of minstrelsy. So she's actually, Daphne Brooks, through her work, Bodies in Descent, I would recommend you read it for those of you who are interested. She's looking at the structure of Afro-alienation, but yet at the same time, understanding that black African-American performers who are performing these particular tropes, it's also an articulation of a sense of economy. And that, I think, is one way in which we can also understand this sense of black performance typologies as we encounter here, or as I've been able to trace and excavate. So, Bonnie Pauline Freeman. Pauline Freeman, she was a soubrette soprano who really starts making her performance space in Chicago. In terms of why she ends up leaving the States at one particular time, I haven't been able to note that. However, she and her partner, Bonnie, I have no idea what his first name is. I have not been able to locate any more information other than what I'm presenting right here. They're known for being cakewalk dancers, that's coming about during the latter part of the 19th century into the early 20th century, and I cannot demonstrate for you. So do not ask me. Okay. However, in the African American press, The Freeman, a review described Pauline Freeman's soubrette voice and coquettish performance of stock characters to numbers such as the 1910 Things Are Coming My Way, which I don't have an example for us. Okay, so they find themselves in Europe, actually. And they're performing in Warsaw and Poland, as well as in Odessa. And then they happen to find themselves in 1914 at the outbreak of World War I. And afterwards, that's when they end up making their way to Constantinople, in which, if we follow their itinerary, they actually come to Constantinople a few times over the course of the 1920s. For short stints, in terms of these kinds of performances, we're looking anywhere from 2 to 3 months to even sometimes as short as a week. It depends on the touring schedules. So I think what Bonnie and Pauline Freeman start to situate for us in Constantinople is simply part of this jazz chronology that I was talking about earlier. But here are the individuals who quite possibly predate black performance in Istanbul itself. And this is when we're going to go back to two specific performers that I've been able to trace, one being Ira Aldridge. He's a very well-known Shakespearean thespian who is the first African-American or black American actor to perform Othello, which typically prior to him was only performed by white actors. He ends up performing in Constantinople in 1866, and I have not been able to find any reviews. So if any of you do, please let me know. Okay, another person, so I really can't speak at length about Ira Aldridge. The other person who I want to introduce, as well as introduce her voice, is Arabella Fields. Now, she has a little more history with the city. She's a contralto lighter singer who ends up making her way to Europe in the 1880s as part of a cappella jubilee groups. So in the late 19th century, we have groups that are performing around Europe, one, jubilee singers, some of them are attached to African universities in the U.S., as well as we have troops who are performing Harriet Beecher Stowe, Uncle Tom's Cabin. That's also circulating at the same time. Arabella Field, she comes across as part of this a cappella jubilee scene. Now, what's interesting, and this is going back to this idea of embodiment and her being very clear about what she's representing. What I'm going to play for you is a coon song. And a coon song, it's basically, we can understand it as a pre-jazz ragtime. It's rhythmically syncopated, and typically it's marked by black minstrel performance. In terms of her dress, she's not representing blackface minstrel performance. In terms of blackface minstrel performance, would have followed this lyric, which is not clear articulated English. So when I play you the example, I want you to pay attention to how she is articulating the language. So instead of way down under the Swanee River, way down upon the Swanee River. So she is formalizing it. So that's what I want you to pay attention to as you listen to it. Can everyone read the lyrics in the back? Yes? Okay.
Oh.
Lovely. Okay, so in terms of the style of musical performance, she's known as a contralto lighter singer. So the stylization lighter would be a 19th century German art song. So we can add that to the kinds of performance styles that someone might have been listening to in Constantinople. Now, she does end up coming for roughly a two-week stint, and she performs at the Parisiana Theater. She does end up coming back to Istanbul by the mid-1920s, and at that point, she's actually a part of a plantation review. We're going to be introduced to the genre of the plantation review in a bit. Excitement. Okay, however, before we get to that, I'm going to introduce you to two more Black American performers who also ended up leaving the U.S. in 1878 and who never came back. So a lot of the information that I'm actually gathering in terms of retracing this kind of Black performance and Black artists, it's not coming from the Ottoman Turkish press. It's coming from the African American press. So specifically, the Chicago Defender, the New York Amsterdam News. Performers are actually using these newspapers to report upon the possibility of finding employment throughout Europe and outside of the U.S. specifically, as well as including the U.S. Another, in terms of trying to sort of map and trace this jazz performance, I'm also working with a lot of jazz collectors, actually. One being, and I forget his name right now, but he's referenced in terms of the source recognition, blah, blah, blah. Okay, I forget that. But there's a really important jazz collector in Germany. I cannot believe. Whatever. Another person is also Adriano Mazzoletti. Adriano Mazzoletti is an Italian jazz historian who also is really focused on the 1920s. Mark Miller, he's based in Canada. He is also someone who has really been sort of tracing this 1920s jazz scene. So I have found their works to be really useful because sometimes, and also in terms of the Darmstadt Jazz Institute, in Germany, that's also been very useful in terms of some of the jazzers who were primarily focused in Europe. But what George Daikin and Billy Brooks is useful for us is, one, they end up basically being based in Cairo from 1914 all the way up until 1929. On December 16th of 1922, the Chicago Defender starts to print the series of letters written by this duo, George Duncan and Billy Brooks, to Tony Langston, who is the theatrical reporter and critic of the Chicago Defender. Brooks and Duncan, as I said, they left the U.S. in 1878, and they traveled nearly two-thirds of the globe before finally settling in Egypt. Their partnership spanned the variety theater circuit from Europe to Russia, from Australia and New Zealand to the Eastern Mediterranean until they actually, and even when they were based in Cairo, they were actually circulating and performing elsewhere. Their letters reflect a changing performance itinerary punctuated with stories of musicians fleeing countries from political unrest to extravagancies in obtaining emergency passports, from the uncertainty of obtaining contracts to the growing expenditures of traveling from one destination to another. The Devil's Jazz Band is what they end up founding in Cairo, and why they are important to thinking outside of this traditional jazz narrative is that they had no experience of early jazz, given the date that they left the U.S. They had no experience to this changing musical landscape in the U.S. itself. They are being introduced to musical styles, either based in Cairo or as they're traveling around. And so I think it provides a really interesting example of how you throw together an early jazz ensemble. So a little bit earlier, I ended up saying, as in terms of James Rhys Stewart, you have sort of set instruments, you know, the alto saxophone, tenor saxophone, the clarinet, banjo, guitar, trumpet, piano, violin. Their combination is a little bit different, actually. They throw together the duo's interpretation of how one might compose a band, as they report back to Tony Langston, is that they threw together a couple of drums, a bit of wood to bang on, and a penny whistle. So that's a very kind of informal performance style. They end up naming their jazz band the Devil's Jazz Band. They also, as they say, mixed up with four Greeks and a Russian. So here I think it's interesting because they're starting to expand outwards this idea of a jazz ecology. At the same time, they're also reporting on specifically who the performers would end up corresponding with. They're trying to get a contract, one of which is Frederick Thomas, who ends up finding his way to Istanbul after the 1917 Russian Revolution. They also report on an individual located in Beirut, as well as in Alexandria. What am I doing with time? I'm going to keep going. So, as I said, I've never been given the stage to provide individuals with this information, and I think this is a perfect audience to do so. I'm not going to get this kind of response in the U.S. I can't imagine. Okay, so now we're going to transition back briefly. I want us now to sort of reorient ourselves back to Constantinople. And here I'm going to go back to information that's coming out of the Far Seas. So we're talking about these kinds of, we can call it informal, we can also call it sort of formal. But Para, in terms of the in terms of 19th century growth of commercialism, of the leisure industry, of this establishment, of a service and catering industry in which we have, as we all know, the rise of hotels, the rise of dancing clubs, the rise of the cafe culture, jazz benefits from this. Jazz benefits from this. We have spaces. We have a mixed population coming into the city, and we also have interest to beckon individuals to come to Constantinople to respond to this new clientele, and that's precisely where Gertrude Dolan and Richard Wheeler, an American duo, dancing couple, who ends up coming to Istanbul. They set up shop in a studio across from the Petit Champ, and they give dancing lessons for roughly a year. Another individual who comes, Judy, is Calvin Cal Keach. Now, he and his brother, Alvin Keach, they both introduced a new instrument, the banjolalis, which is a combination of the banjo and the ukulele. But they are inspired by the ukulele when they were in Hawaii. Now, Cal Keach, he ends up offering private banjo lessons in Para. And he also ends up becoming the individual to represent the banjolalis company that's based in London. He happens to be their Constantinople operator. So that's another interesting way in terms of thinking about this jazz culture sort of pervading throughout the city, or the district specifically. Okay, now I'm going to zoom in, and I apologize in terms of the lack of clarity for this map, but so I've mentioned this is the bar for the Garden Bar, this is the theater for the Petit Champ. The Maxime Bar, which we, as we all know, is on Cité Cellulaire, that's off the map. But these informal spaces of jazz performance, one is located right here. It's called Gregory's. So this is Osmala Masjid. This is Istiklal Caddesi. I think this is now some kind of tennis shoe store. I don't know. So we have just informal jazz gigs. So going back to the Sultan of Samsun production image that I showed at the very beginning of the talk, now like an hour ago, after the individuals would perform at these specific sponsored events, later they would end up going to late night gigs for dancing and drinking and music making at these little bars that were established also by U.S. sailor amateur musicians. So we don't have sort of the longevity of these kinds of spaces. Another location, the Tocatlian Hotel, the Ishan right now, right next to it, there's the two streets, and I forget actually both of the street names, but the building that's in the middle, on the top floor, was another location of a late night jazz bar in which people could actually jazz until 2, all the way up until 4 o'clock in the morning. So this kind of business advertisement specifically focused for U.S. clientele, this is also sort of emerging from the far seas. Frederick Bruce Thomas. I think maybe some of us have probably come across his name. He is an impresario who ends up setting up shop in Moscow. He's also a very important impresario prior to his coming to Istanbul after the 19th. So he comes in the 1919 wave from Odessa. He is known as an impresario. He is not an introducer of jazz. He's part of this jazz ecology. I think right now in terms of popular renderings of the early 1920s jazz scene in Istanbul, he is being put forward as this icon, as this individual who's really promoting and introducing jazz. However, if we think about early jazz performance and black performance, there's already a particular kind of movement taking place prior to him actually coming and establishing Maxim's. However, he is important. Frederick Thomas is important, but I want to stress that he doesn't introduce, because he is not a musician. But he is a supporter. He does end up, over the course of when he's attached to the Moscow's Aquarium, he does make annual 6-week trips to Paris and other major urban centers throughout Europe to actually garner and contract performers to come back to Moscow. Now we're going to be moving into more of a listening section. The next artist who I'm going to introduce you to is Arthur Briggs. Now, Arthur Briggs, he also primarily makes his name in the jazz world in Paris. In 1927, we have a very interesting rendering of Constantinople. The New York Amsterdam news reporter J.A. Rogers interviewed musicians passing through Paris's jazz scene. The trombonist and composer Earl B. Grandstaff, right here, he's part of the Arthur Briggs troupe. Earl B. Grandstaff, who had recently toured through Paris, he was a trumpeter and trombonist with Arthur, or he was a trombonist for the trumpeter Arthur Briggs, ends up remarking to J.A. Rogers that black musicians were, quote, occupying more and higher positions in Constantinople than in any other place. Now, he's making this comment in 1927. In terms of the actual physical numbers of the jazzers, that is very up in the air. By 1932, a reporter for the New York Times, J.W. Koenig, he ends up reporting that there are 10,000 jazz musicians in the city, which I think is greatly exaggerated. Greatly exaggerated. However, there's still this indication that there is this scene. So I'm going to hear part of the itinerary for Arthur Briggs as he plays at Maxim's. And then he also plays at the Villa Tom, which is another location that Frederick Thomas ended up opening up in Turabia. So that's off the para map. So let's listen to Arthur Briggs. Thank you. This is our last listening selection. So I'm going to be rounding up, sort of. Okay, one more individual that I want you to introduce, that I want to introduce you to, is going back to the Penn Jebel promotional material in terms of the listing of the various places that he performed from the 1924 all the way up until 1931. Here is the gentleman right here seated, Sam Wooding, who's the American jazz band leader. He ends up coming to and performs at the Petit Champ Theater. He ends up finding himself initially in Europe in 1925 as part of the Plantation Review, the Chocolate Kitties, that he actually ended up composing the music to. Sam Wooding is important because he also becomes an individual who's important to the last individual that I'm going to introduce you for the night. He's going to follow Sam Wooding, and that is Lewis Douglas. So there's actually a lot of creative innovation that's taking place amongst these individuals who are located in Europe for the most part, who do, not necessarily all the time. Arthur Briggs doesn't really go back to New York. He's primarily just based in Paris, but there is some of this transatlantic crossing that's also taking place in which we do find these individuals making their way to Constantinople. So let's listen just briefly to Sam Wooding's orchestra and the Shanghai Shuffle. Who is part of Sam Wooding's orchestra is Tommy Ladner. I'm going to mention him briefly because he's a contemporary of Louis Armstrong. He's from New Orleans, and he is known as having a particular hot sound. So in terms of the variety of jazz sounds or early jazz sounds that's percolating through Istanbul, part of it is this hot sound, this very sort of rhythmic, and then we also have the stylizations, which I don't have an example for us of the equivalent of a Ted Lewis or a Paul Whiteman, so more formalized, not necessarily as peppy as what I've just been playing for you. So let's just listen to Tommy Ladner really quickly. And, geez, it's not working. So very much a very sort of New Orleans style. Mention Lewis Douglas. Lewis Douglas, he arrives in the European scene in 1925 as part of the plantation review, La Revue Nègre, which was performed in Paris. And that is where European audiences are introduced to Josephine Baker. And that is where the performance style of the Charleston, which all of this music, in terms of the movement that's expressed, the movement that's expressing the music, that is this arms akimbo, knocked knee. Very sexualized. See, I'm performing right now.
You're performing the dance.
However, he's a choreographer, he's a dancer, and he brings three plantation reviews to Istanbul. Plantation reviews, I'm going to read this really quick definition for those of you who might not be able to. So multi-act reviews featuring large casts and elaborate sets which played on caricaturized tropes of southern scenes sweltering under humidity and lush vegetation. So there's really sort of a variation of the theme taking place here. In terms of large casts, Louisiana Troupe, which comes and performs in Constantinople in 1929, there's 46 members. A lot of the music, Sam Wooding's composing the music to the Plantation Reviews. Not performing it, but he's composing the music. We also have Arabella Fields, who we were introduced earlier. She also is featured in some of these Plantation Reviews that are brought to Constantinople. So we really have this really diverse communication between the performers who are located here. Now, in terms of Lewis Douglas, this idea of a performance style Charleston, there is only one particular, there's very little visual images of precisely what this dance looked like or how he danced, because that's also how he made his living as a choreographer, except for this one film clip. In 1930, Lewis Douglas, he made his first full-length talking. Now, granted, he's not talking. And he's dancing to the music as performed by Sidney Bechet, who's located, originally from New Orleans, he's located in Paris. And it's part of this movie. It's a clip from, pardon my German, Ein Brecher? Okay.
Sorry.
Or the burglars. The film ends up employing dancers and bar musicians, none of which are credited in the film itself in terms of the listing of the credits. Now, the film features the German actors are Willy Frisch, Lillian Harvey, Heinz Ruchmann, Ralph Arthur Roberts, Oskar Sima, Kurt Gerhon, with music written by Friedrich Holländer, as well as music performed by Sidney Bechet. And the story is really light. We're not really going to be looking at the story itself, which follows this really light French comedy style. But at the very end of the story, it takes place in a Paris Negro bar, a Neger bar. Now, it's actually filmed in Weimar, Berlin. And we have, we're going to watch it, not in its entirety, but you'll see one woman who comes out and is positioned as dancing the Charleston. The man who joins her is Lewis Douglas. That's what I want you to focus on. Is that working? No. I'm energetic. Okay, so just to wrap up really briefly, I want us to think in terms of, and this is part of the research that I'm not able to actually prove quite yet because I haven't been able to somehow make the connection to this one particular image. Because we have very visuals of this Turkish operetta or operettes tradition that starts to emerge by the late 1920s. However, if we start thinking about the different kinds of black performance typologies that are circulating, and granted, I've been able to give you some visual examples, one being here, Josephine Baker from 1928, this image being found in Vieux Gazette. We're not going to be able to actually think about this establishment of early jazz criticism or this reference to Josephine Baker, Charleston Queen of the Negro Pleasure, received applause for the first time by civilized people. That's going to be something that we're not going to be able to tackle tonight. That's going to be the second part. However, in terms of black performance typologies, in terms of if we think about it, going back to Ira Aldridge, so we have the Shakespearean actor. Then we move on to Arabella Fields, a very particular formalized, stylized contralto, lighter example. And then we move on to Bonnie and Freeman. There are cakewalk dancers. And then we have, okay, Duncan and Brooks. I don't know if they actually came to Constantinople, but they're also being sort of suggestive of sort of this fusion of this vaudevillian style into what we start to think about as early jazz. And then we move into the jazz typologies that's focused around the music that I've been introducing to you. And then we have these plantation reviews. However, when we actually think about this one particular image from Jamal Rashid Ray's Ujzat, which is from 1932, the typologies are very similar. Now, in terms of influences that could have come, we're not sort of negating the fact that there's a lot of traveling that's taking place between these various urban centers. The ways in which this kind of visual information representation is popping up in the illustrated press, as well as what people are seeing in terms of live performance. So that's one particular element that I would like to continue to explore after the book is out. Another thing in terms of thinking about what all of this information is useful for is starting to think about how do we start writing, or what are going to be the contours of an early jazz Turkish historiography, even in terms of the field, because the one seminal text that is referred to by in popular histories as well as in academic texts happens to be this 1958 İlhan Mimar Luz Caz Sanatı. That's really sort of the establishment of this what we start to sort of understand is maybe early jazz historiography, which is way more complicated, actually. If we start thinking, which I'm not going to be able to talk to you about, is the ways in which people are actually writing about jazz and performance styles in the pages of the illustrated press. Now, even in terms of the term jazz, it roughly starts to be introduced in the 1920s, but it's really difficult to say when. But we do, it does end up appearing prior to 1958 in Faruk Yener's Musical Terminologies. I forget the actual title of the book, which is first printed in 1946, but here, or yeah, 1945, 1946, and then it was reprinted in the 1960s. But here we actually have an entry for jazz that's it being introduced in the Turkish lexicon. It's a completely different time period in terms of jazz performance. Okay, read through the contours of what this early jazz criticism is, and I cannot talk about it. So lack of categorization. Jazz is neither a la Turca, and it is not a la Franga. It is completely different. Transcultural dialogue, I've mentioned that. Spread of dancing as it pertains to early jazz. It's around sort of 1922 that starts popping up in the Turkish press. Concerns for health, the idea of modern addictions. I want to mention briefly dance's miscegenation. Dance's miscegenation specifically between dancing between Muslim as well as Muslim women dancing and learning how to dance from Greek and Armenian dance teachers. That ends up implicating this particular kind of socioeconomic politics around non-Muslim leisure spaces in PETA. And I think that's it.